This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
There are subjects, as you regular listeners know, that are fun, filled with laughter, and even when you're talking God talk, you can giggle every once in a while. And maybe even on this show, too, because it's about grief and bereavement and loss. Those are the negative words. Can there ever be positive words? Well, we'll certainly find out, won't we? Because we have a professional with us as a director of bereavement services with Hospice of the Valley. And the Valley, in this case, is the Valley of the Sun, even though this broadcast is international and you have your own valley, I'm sure, just outside of Melbourne, Australia, or wherever you are listening in Singapore. You have an opportunity to share all of this with us because it is, after all, one of the few subjects that we've discussed that we all share, and that is the loss of someone close to us. But how do you do it? How do you do it well? Well, Stacia Ortega has a career that is involved with teaching people how to handle grief. And I'd like you to meet Stacia right now as I ask her, since we all have grieved, and the staff that puts this show together is going to individually be sharing with you and the audience their own personal stories. We've never done this before, about how we have handled grief or not done it well. But since we have all grieved, those in the audience and those here on the staff of The God Show, is there an appropriate length of time for grief? Stacia?
No. And grief is very individualistic, and it's different for everybody. So when we put a timetable on grief, we put a lot of pressure on people to sort of check the boxes and, you know, do the stages that we've all heard about and then be done. And unfortunately, it's not as easy as that. And everyone is going to do it in their own way, on their own timetable.
How do you find out what your own way is?
Well, it has a lot to do with who you are as a person, how you express. So one of the most important things we can do in a time of loss is move the pain from the inside of ourselves to the outside of ourselves. And we do that through mourning. And so many of us think of mourning as the traditional things that we see, like a memorial service or a funeral or crying. But we're individuals, and not everybody does those things. Not everybody cries. Some people have to be active and instrumental in their grief. They need to physically do something. So somebody may run a marathon as opposed to sitting down and talking and expressing their feelings. So we don't label expression. We just want to see that we have expression and that we're moving that pain from the inside of ourselves to the outside. And we're going to do that in our own individual ways based on what works for us.
Boy, it really is personal, isn't it?
It is very personal.
I remember reading not long ago in one of those, one of those Dear Somebody columns, the advice columns. And the letter was critical of a person who had just lost, I don't know, a husband, an uncle, but somebody close, could have been a parent. And they said, can you imagine, dear Ruffy, whomever it is that was the recipient, can you imagine, I went to the services and she was in the front row crying at the loss of her family member. And after the service, I went to dinner in a nearby restaurant, and there she was with a big table full of people from the service laughing and having a wonderful time. How dare she answer that?
Well, just because we're grieving doesn't mean we're not living. And sometimes what helps us in our grief is to take a break from the intensity of it, the emotion of it. So putting our grief on a shelf momentarily is okay. And being able to connect with others, to have a moment of joy, even in a time that is so profoundly bereft of that, it's okay. Because if we're in the intensity of the pain 24/7, it may just be too much. So when we're judged, it can complicate our grief as well.
Do you mind if I take just a moment to answer that letter that was sent, critical of the person having the freedom to laugh over an afternoon dinner after the service, okay? And to that person, I say personally and affectionately, mind your own damn business. Just drives me crazy when people do that. Let's talk about individual stories. Rosemary Scarfo has been my radio my radio savior, if you will, on the God Show for how many years?
Oh, let's say maybe 34.
Okay, so that means 34 years and 52 weeks of God's show. That's a whole bunch of shows. And I know how many that it takes to give me whiplash when I see the Google listing of just the last couple of hundred of the God shows that we've done. And you have booked them all. You found the guests for all of them.
And I just heard a new definition of producer, a talk show producer.
What?
Babysitter.
I think
that is a wonderful...
We've been together long enough that I can giggle about
that. You better giggle.
Because guess who the baby is. Okay. So I know that you have in your years with your family and with your friends and so on experienced grief. Pick one. Just pick one example.
Okay. What I'd like to do, I am, because it's very, it just very recently. But I do want to, I don't know if this is appropriate right now, but I do want to address when that letter about having fun.
Oh, the one that I was talking about?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
I have a feeling that no matter what I ask you, you're probably going to just simply take the show into your own hands.
Absolutely. You bet.
But no, I want to hear what because you didn't know what I was going to say.
No. There were an awful lot of, that I've heard that people, children, adults, think that if I start feeling better, it means that I'm forgetting and I'm not caring. Mm. And I think that that's what the gentleman or lady thought, you know, that they just don't care anymore. But when you said this is life. But can you address that, though? If I start feeling better, I still care.
Of course. And what we hope happens is that we are able to reinvest in life, but always carrying our loved ones with us. Even though they are not here physically with us, we are able to carry them in our hearts. They're always part of us. And so if we're having fun, it doesn't discount the love, the relationships we've had. It means that we're continuing to live, and they're still part of us.
Good. And I think that that's probably one of the last things that I'm going to make sure that I want everyone to know is just go ahead and cry, but then laugh. I don't want anybody to go on and on and on and miss me.
May I arrange the catering for the party?
Yes, you. Oh, you always pick good places. Go ahead.
No, of the people you've lost both of your parents, I know, and you've lost close friends, you've lost business associates.
Yes.
Even recently.
Right.
Pick one area of your personal grief.
Okay. And this just happened last week, a couple weeks ago. Mm. both happened. We lost a colleague that in the news department that we've been working with for many, many, many
years.
At our
radio station.
Yes, right. Steve Cawson. We lost him. But then what really, really affected me was a family on their way to Mass on Mother's Day. And five children, and mom and dad. The oldest was 14. The youngest was 6. A drunk driver driving the wrong way. And the oldest child was killed.
Oh, gosh.
I know the mom, worked with the mom, and on Facebook, and her husband's joy at each child that was born, and their families, they were just such a wonderful, wonderful family. It struck me so deeply, and I couldn't get rid of the pain. I feel other people's pain, but I could not get rid of the fact of the mom and dad's pain of losing their oldest child.
And may I add, you were on a short vacation at that period of time, and the environment around you was one of celebratory friendships and great dining and lovely personal private experiences that were going to even remove Rosemary from the pressures and the tensions of her workday.
And Stacia,
and then this happened.
I was sitting at the pool, like nobody asking me questions, nobody, and then this came up. So I couldn't do anything. I would just sat there at the pool and kept thinking of the mom and kept thinking of the dad. How? And I couldn't shake it. Okay, I wanted to do something. I can't do anything. Okay, help me.
Well, first I want to offer my condolences about your colleague to all of you, and certainly this most recent loss in a very traumatic way. I think when there is a loss that's traumatic, unexpected, sudden, that takes on a different shape for us. It's all losses are difficult, even if we have awareness that somebody's ill, somebody may be older, we can rationalize those things, they're all difficult. When it comes to traumatic loss, when it's sudden, unexpected, and then somebody who's younger, how old was the
14.
Child? 14. So out of the chronological order, or what we would consider normative, because when I lost my grandmother, who was almost 98 years old, it was difficult, but I knew she had lived a long life, and it wasn't unexpected. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's 14, we don't expect for that to happen, and we don't expect it to happen in a traumatic way. So it makes sense to me that you would be thinking about it and having difficulty with shaking that thought process.
Just hanging on in there, especially the feelings of the mom and dad.
Yeah.
And it was like over and over again.
What can she do, though? What can Rosemary do? I don't mean when she's by the pool in Palm Springs. I mean when she comes back and she also regularly is in touch with the other colleagues who shared that family.
Yeah, so great question. I think, first of all, you're doing it. You're talking about it. I think putting expression to those feelings that you're having of relating to the parents, any of us who have been a parent have a difficult time relating and thinking about what that would be like to lose a child or a grandchild or anybody in our life that way. So being able to move it from the inside of yourself to the outside by talking about it, talking to others about it, being a supportive presence for the family in the ways that you can, emotionally for yourself, maybe bringing the community together to support that family in the help that they're going to need to move forward, I think are the most important things you can do right
and
now.
And we are part of the same radio station, and so I lost the same colleague. And while I was not as close to her and her family as Rosemary was, I will ask you this on behalf of everyone who, under these circumstances, the unthinkable circumstances of losing anyone, much less a 14-year-old about to embark on life because of a drunk driver. You tell me, as the professional, how I handle the hate that I have in my life, my heart, my soul, against the guy that did that.
Yeah, that's a tough question, because it's normal for us to feel those things, especially when there's been culpability, there's been a cause, there's been an action, a behavior, something that has caused this significant loss. And it is normal to express anger about it and to be honest about that. Also, to be able to work through that to a place of forgiveness for ourselves about that can be helpful, but that's a journey. That's a real journey.
What do you mean forgiveness for ourselves? I didn't do anything. I wasn't the one who was drinking. I wasn't the one who got behind the wheel.
Yeah. So sometimes when we are able to forgive that action, we are actually, forgiveness benefits ourselves and how we continue to cope. But again, that's not something that happens overnight. That is a long process of really coming to terms with what occurred and making peace with that.
How do I find that long journey, even at the beginning of it? How do I start? Do I start with somebody else?
So we start by, again, putting words to it, being able to express what we're experiencing, including anger, because that is part of our journey, is to feel anger at times. Some people even feel anger with the universe about things. For example, in COVID, when we were all living in a time of not understanding what was happening and lots of loss and not understanding why it was occurring and feeling, how could this be happening to our world? We have an assumptive world about how life should be. Somebody should not be driving, and this should, you know, this should not have occurred, right? And so we have to be able to express our feelings about that to start to make sense of it to the best of our ability. And we also have to allow ourselves to experience the pain. And grief is the hardest work anyone will ever do.
Mm.
It's like touching the hot stove. And when you feel it, you don't want to touch it. But the way through it is leaning into it and leaning into that pain. And it's counterintuitive because we want to pull away from it. But the more we can lean into that and allow that to eke out of ourselves in our way of expressing it, whether it's anger or crying or doing something instrumental, we start to work through it.
How about anger at the creator of the universe? Hey, God, he was 14, and you let that guy load up on booze and get behind the wheel and kill that little boy. And God, I'm not ready to forgive you.
Yeah. So very normal, again, to be angry with God. And and my thought about it is that God is big enough to take it, right? That the universe sometimes is an imperfect place. And why do bad things happen to good people? Why do these things happen? And we don't always have an answer for that.
Robin Côté is the silent member of our staff. except when she's telling me that I messed up. But Robin is the studio director. She's the one who handles all the technical things, the placement of the microphones, and making sure that all the microphones are operating properly when we're doing a show with someone across the country or around the other side of the world. She's the person who is responsible for the quality of the signal and all of those things, actually, technically, that allow us to do this program. And I invited Robin to be a part of this program because I couldn't think of anyone that had never experienced grief. And then when I found out that Robin has really experienced grief, while I'm asking you to pick one experience, Robin, can you briefly tell us about that huge number of people that have passed in your life?
I've had well over 75 people pass away in my life, and the biggest part of that was the period between 22 and 33 years of age. I lost 41 people, and it was death really has taught me a lot, Pat, and I think the one that sticks out the most to me is losing my husband to cancer. He was only 36. Mm. We were only married 7 months and only together for 17 months when he passed away. So I became a widow at the age of 33. And I had to make the end of life choices for him because being so young, his family did not have anything written down to, you know, what his wishes were. So he almost died twice prior. And at that point, I sat with him in the hospital and I said, we need to talk about this. We need to make some decisions because your family is your family. And they're not going to understand this, but I'm sitting here with you right now after having gone through so much death in my life. Let's talk about what you want done in case we go through this again, where it's your time to go. And that conversation was not easy, but yet it was. And being able to understand at my age of 33 that this is what this man wanted carried out, and being that strong person sitting there and being able to focus on him in that very moment, compartmentalizing my own heart and my own feelings, knowing that this might be the next time he dies, and I have to be prepared for that. But I have to tell you, Pat, he gave me the greatest gift out of anybody ever in this lifetime. And I can sit here 22 years later and tell you that the moment that he died, we were all standing around him and his family broke out in screams and cries. And all I could do was just smile because he was smiling at me. He let me know that in that moment of death, there was nothing to fear. And he gave me the greatest gift of all, by showing me that there's something far greater than what we have going on here on Earth. And they don't want us to sit around and be miserable and be unhappy. He showed me, not even a minute after he passed away, that he was still with me. And there's so many things that we don't truly understand in life. Death scares us, but if we loosen our minds a little bit to see that they never really leave us. They physically are not here on the planet with us, but they show us signs. Pennies, butterflies, dragonflies, cardinal birds. There's all kinds of signs that come around when our loved ones show up. And a lot of times we're so caught up in our grief and our emotions that we don't always see those signs, but sometimes if we just allow ourselves that moment, we'll see that they're really still around us, and they show us these signs. 22 years later, my husband Cliff is still with me. He shows me these signs every now and then to remind me that, hey, I'm still here. I want you to live your life and be happy, but I'm still here with you.
Robin Côté, and an experience that is enriching and encouraging, but is it common?
It can be common. Many people do experience having signs from their loved one. Not everybody, but it can be a very comforting way to feel the continuing bond.
Well, look at how Robin feels now this many years later, and she still has that level of warmth and the memory of what her experience was.
Yeah. And the funny thing about grief is that we can really grow as people when we experience it. I know that sounds weird because, again, who wants to experience this pain or the loss of somebody? But it can really reshape us. And we do live our lives differently, but it can be enhanced in many ways. And that's what we hope for.
Does the ritual make any difference as far as your experience is concerned? The ritual of passing. You are with a hospice organization. In another environment might be traditionally religious. In another environment, it might involve music and friends and dancing. Does the ritual make any difference?
I think ritual is very important when the ritual itself is connected to the people that are participating in it, meaning it has to be meaningful to the loved ones. And ritual, we have so much ritual in our lives about how we honor people through their dying process and after they die. And rituals are tools that can help us to start to express and be present in those moments. But again, they have to be meaningful to you.
Do you have any stories? Do you have any memories of someone, you know, family getting together? And you know, like we're saying, everyone has different rituals.
Yeah, I mean, I can share a personal story if you want about when my grandmother was dying on hospice service. And we were all there when she was actively dying. And my cousin said, "I think she needs pie." And I thought, knowing what I know about hospice and medicine, I thought, well, she doesn't need any food at this point. And I realized that that was really about memories. So he left and he went to the store, bought a piece of pie, brought it back, and fed her a little piece of pie so that she could taste it. And it just was a beautiful memory and moment.
Yes.
To have the space to be able to do that. Again, it wasn't going to change the course of her illness. It wasn't going to change her dying. It was a beautiful family moment for us because that pie was connected to memories of baking and childhood and family gathering. So that's an example of a ritual, even though it's not a big elaborate ritual, but it was meaningful for him and for all of us.
And I think that we need to take those chances of doing that. I mean, you know, I this person is dying, so we don't do anything. We just watch them. But to go get the pie and go get
I'm impressed with that guy.
Yes, me too. Me too. And you know what else that I've noticed is when hospice becomes involved, a baby doll is involved also.
What?
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, so sometimes our patients that are living with dementia, they can be comforted by a baby doll because they've been caregivers throughout their life. And it is comforting to hold that baby and be a caregiver again. And so that's where that would be used.
And I think, I'm sorry, I think that
I've never heard you say I'm sorry to me. In all these years, you've never apologized.
I
mean,
I interrupted you. I think I would like to have that. At first I thought, oh my goodness, you know, a baby doll. But then that holding, having something near. Remember that, Pat, when I'm on my deathbed.
I've already purchased the wine.
Well, we die like we live. So we go into our dying how we've always lived. the things that are important to us. I would have 500 dogs around.
Oh, yeah. And my wife and I probably would be bringing the family dog, whether they were happy with that idea at wherever it is that we were. I would probably ask them to buzz off and leave
do it
us,
anyway.
Leave us to our own personal family celebration. But then there are those other things, Stacia. We're talking about Stacia Ortega, a director of bereavement services at Hospice of the Valley. And I know that you probably are schooled in absolutely one thing that is rigidly there, and that is don't criticize what people want to do. And I've always thought that an open casket was a primitive kind of thing. And I don't care how splendid the makeup specialists are at a mortuary. No, she doesn't look like she's living. I'm sorry. I've never seen anybody yet that looks as good as when I remember them the week or the month or the year before. It has nothing to do with the spirits escaping or anything like that. No, it's just, I have my memory of the appearance of this person, and an open casket just is uncomfortable for me. And then when someone in the family insists that a child touch the face, have you been around that kind of ritual?
I've not been around it, but I'm aware of that.
And you can't really do anything about saying, no, don't do that. Don't tell that child that he has to touch the corpse.
Yeah, I think many times going back in history, open casket was a very common practice, and it was really to help, you know, or the thought was that people could really understand that the person was not coming back, to really get to acceptance that the person is no longer here in the physical presence. And I think we see less of it today in today's world. But to your point, there are times that occurs. Sometimes it can be cultural, just a culture within a family. With children, you know, that's tough, because if it's the cultural practice of the family, maybe they include children in that. And so looking at it from a vantage point can be challenging, because you wonder why is that happening, and has that child been prepared for what that means?
Yes, Rosemary has something to say, and I have no doubt that it's something in and around the open casket.
Absolutely. But the children,
mm-hmm.
I agree that many times the children should not be present. My children, one of our very dear friends, whipped up my 4-year-old daughter when her husband died and said, come on, let's go see. Mm. And she took her up to the casket, and now my daughter just, I don't want to.
Yeah, kiss
for
your
me.
Uncle. I've heard that. I've not been around it. Kiss your uncle in the casket.
Well, I don't agree with that either. And I believe that I do touch dead people. That doesn't bother me at all. But there are other people that can't and that won't, and that's fine. But I do have something to say about an open casket. My family would not want me to be in an open casket, but I won't mind it at all. I have been with this body now for many years.
How many?
I'm not telling you. A lot of years. And it has carried my spirit. It has carried me through everything in this life. and God gave me this life, and I'm enjoying this life as crappy as it can get sometimes, but when I die, I want my body to be buried. I don't want to throw it in an incinerator. I'm sorry, I'm being disrespectful. I do not want it to be cremated. This is what I went through in life, and this is what I want to be at the end of my life. So you can come and look at me and say, ooh, she looks awful, or ooh, she looks nice, or she's smiling, or whatever, but that's fine. But that's how I want to end it.
Right, and we'll certainly see to it that your wishes are fulfilled. You and a bottle of wine and an open casket.
You bet, put Robin, that in there.
Robin, you were talking about earlier, I didn't even inquire how it is that you managed to get through your life and 70-something people in your life didn't make it to this point. Why? I mean, that seems to be an extraordinary number.
Well, I mean, I was associated with a lot of creative people working in the different industries of radio and television and music. So a lot of the people that were around me at that time, you know, you're dealing with everything from suicide to automobile accidents to a lot of cancer. Mm. But, you know, given the creative personalities, there were a lot of people that struggled with depression and suicide. So a lot of those 41 that died within that 11-year period were, in fact, suicide. So that kind of, you know, it puts you into a different place when you're going to anywhere between 5 to 10 funerals a year. And
wow.
And you're losing, I'm losing intricate parts of my circle. And this all started at 23 to 34. So within that very important time in my life where I'm cultivating professional and personal circles, I'm losing those people that I count on. And, you know, I had a friend who pointed out to me, he said, you're in their life to learn from their deaths. You're being prepared for something. And when you're told this in your, you know, your 30s, you're looking at this going, oh, whatever. I mean, you know, what is that supposed to mean? And right after he said that was when I met my late husband, not even a week after. And then within 17 months, I'm making the decisions that are end of life care. I had to give my husband permission to die. And when you are faced with that, it puts you in a position where you're outside of yourself. You can't think selfishly that I don't want you to go. I love you. My son and I love you and adore you. You have to come from the perspective of we're going to be fine. We're going to be okay. The cancer's not going to go away. It's getting worse and there's nothing they can do.
But at some point, did you not, Robin, as a human being, say, why me?
My whole life has been very tough, starting from childhood. And when I had my son at a young age, I was 17, I never thought about the why me. I focused on my son because I didn't want him to go through what I did as a child. So I never thought about the why me. I just did what I did. And then all of the beautiful people that have come and gone in my life, it was more like, why did that happen to them? Why did this 23-year-old have to fall off the back of a truck and get killed? Why did this 30-year-old have to suffer with cancer and die and leave her husband and 5-year-old son behind? It was never about why me. It was questioning. And I was never angry at God, but I always asked him, why? Why am I losing all of these people? Why? Does it mean, I mean, it's like, I had people say, well, I don't know if I want to be friends with you. You've had too many friends die. You're like friends with the Grim Reaper or something. And that kind of hurt to hear that because I had lost a lot of people that meant something to me. And I never thought about why me. I just kept going and going and going because I had to.
And I'm sure that that probably is the healthiest of all possible attitudes, that I just kept going and going and going because I had to.
Yeah, I think you're super courageous, and thank you so much for sharing that. And I just wanted to touch on one of the things you said about somebody not being wanting to be around you because of, you know, being like a grim reaper. I do think sometimes when we're grieving, people are well-intentioned, mm-hmm. and they want to be supportive, but they're afraid, or they've never been through a situation.
They don't know what to
grief.
Say.
They don't know what to say. Yeah. So they may be standoffish. They may do the wrong things. They may say the wrong things. You know, the euphemisms that we hear all the time that aren't helpful, because they also can be fearful of seeing what that pain is and not wanting to go through that themselves.
And I want to bring up a point, Pat, before you move on. When we talk about our loved ones that have passed on, that's important to us to keep their memories alive, because if we don't do that, they really do die. So when people approach us, they're afraid. I have some people that will tell me, well, she's still talking about her dead husband. It's like, well, of course, because that's how much he meant to me. He changed my life forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do that. I memorialize my friends all the time that have passed on. But then you have the other people that are afraid to approach you. And again, they don't know what to say. They're afraid to bring it up because they think it might hurt you. It's like, no, have that discussion. Say, tell me about, like, my husband's name was Cliff. It's like, tell me about Cliff. What kind of person was he? Let's keep that going to where we keep the memories alive. Why do we have to bury somebody and then just go away from it? People, especially people who have lost their children, they don't want to forget that their children ever existed. So if you're sitting down with them, bring it up. Talk about it. It may be fresh at first, but even a year or two down the road, anniversaries, birthdays, post something on their wall. If they're talking about their dead child, happy birthday, you know, whatever, happy heavenly birthday, post something nice and tell them you're sending them hugs and thoughts for the day. Just something that simple.
Good advice.
Can make all the difference to somebody, because if we don't keep their memory alive, then they really do die 100%. And us who have lost people in our lives, those especially closest to our hearts, we're not going to be offended at that if you bring it up. We're not going to be mad at you if you bring that up. Watch somebody's face and how their smile comes out when you start talking about their loved one who has passed on, even if it's 20 years later. Brings a smile to your face because that person meant something.
Stacia, what do you think?
I think absolutely it's a beautiful thing when we can mention people by name and we can continue to, you know, ask questions and keep, you know, that relationship alive for people. We live in a society where we kind of pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and we do grief the same way. That's an expectation that we're just going to, you know, do our few days of mourning and we're going to move on. And we need to be allowed to have that space and to continue that and have that support around us. We need people to hold us in this time so that we're not alone in it.
And now it's my turn. And having had really a long and rich and wonderful life that I wouldn't trade with anyone, I've lost people that were as close to me as my parents. I've lost a wife. I go through the variety, doing this program in advance, I was thinking, well, who would I talk about? Who would I talk about? Because I really haven't experienced grief that much. When I lost my parents individually, we had been on one side of the country and another for so long, and we still communicated, but it was one of those things where every once in a while we would have occasion to visit, but not that often. And then there was Mike Condello. And Mike Condello, Stacia, was a musician that came into my life. You said that you watched my kids' show when you were growing up. And he was the music director from the time that he was 15 years old. And my partner, the producer of the show, Wallace, tracked him down because he had been recommended as a great teacher of other children to teach the guitar. And Wallace's daughter showed an interest in that. He said, well, let's check this Mike guy out. And the benefits, of course, that Mike provided was he not only was a brilliant musician, not only creative, but he was funny. And he had this great sense of humor around Wallace. Well, that's all you needed with him. And so at 15, he became the music director of the show. And so needless to say, we're talking about somebody that close. I've lost Wallace. I've lost Landmo, my other partner on the television show. But we were together. I was on the show for 30 years. They were on 6 years before that. It was a long, long marriage professionally. And there was never, ever enmity. As close as we were 5 days a week and then a couple of days on the weekends going out to different parts of the state to do stage shows, we were that close, closer than many marriages. And we found that we had virtually nothing in common. Mm-hmm. As individuals, we didn't live in the same neighborhood. We didn't grow up in an environment that was even close to one another. And yet, there was such an incredible feeling of family. And that included Mike. And Mike was what I always thought of as an Italian leprechaun, this darling little precious personality, would find humor in almost everything, loved music. We shared the Beatles, all of those things, including a willingness to grab life, take a hunk out of it, chew it up, digest it, and make it part of you. That was Mike. Everything. Everything was something he could get involved in. And there was always that sense of humor. And after a while, after years and years and years with the Wallace and Landmo show, he decided to follow his recording career in Los Angeles. And we had had a recording career ourselves together, but he wanted to see what he could do as a composer, and he went over and met the person that he eventually wound up asking to be his bride. And so with a marriage coming up in a very short period of time, and a career that was developing, my wife and I happened to be doing my radio program in Moscow. And we went into the office before the program started, and they said, the radio station's been trying to get in touch with you. And I said, well, they probably want to know if the signal is. He said, no, there was something personal about Los Angeles. And we called, and Stacey, we found out that Michael not only died, but that he shot himself to death. A matter of a couple of months before he was going to get married. Hated guns. To the best of our knowledge, never owned one. And he killed himself? Well, that one was the one time when I could say honestly to you, as a bereavement counselor, I've never gotten over it. Mm. How do I?
Well, that, again, I offer my sincere condolences. That is heartbreaking. And I was thinking as you were talking, there are some people in this lifetime that just touch us in a way that's different than others. I don't know what that's about, but we all have had that experience, and it sounds like this is one of those experiences. Sounds like such a lovely person. Suicide is so, so difficult and challenging. We just can't wrap our heads around when somebody looks on the outside like they have everything going for them, and then this happens.
And please, please pursue that. We've got about 5 minutes left, and if we just do nothing but talk about the unthinkable. He died. He didn't commit suicide. We don't say that anymore. But he died as a result of suicide. But so did so many other people. How do we handle that?
Yeah. Well, we need to talk about it. We need to educate ourselves about it. Sometimes we just have nothing we can do, right? Because we have no idea that this is happening.
But I'm angry at him for doing it.
Yes, and anger goes hand in hand with suicide loss. And it is very normal and natural to feel angry, especially when you see somebody who looks to be thriving and has everything possible to in their lives coming, and the hurt that that can create for others in their lives. It makes sense that you would be angry about that. And I think with suicide loss, we have to allow space for people to be angry. And one way to think about it is that, you know, we as humans do everything we can to survive. I think about, you know, being lost at sea and floating on a piece of wood and sharks nipping at our feet. We will do everything to continue to tread water and survive. So when we think about somebody who takes their life by suicide, what profound despair they must be in. And I heard someone one time, actually a priest, talk about suicide as like a disease like cancer, that, you know, sometimes we can't do anything about it. It's so profound. And so we need a lot of support when we are grieving a suicide loss. We need specific support. So we need to talk to someone who really understands suicide. It is unique.
Like who do you find?
Well, I mean, locally, there's a great organization in Phoenix called MPACT, and they specialize on suicide and groups for survivors of suicide because it is so specific and unique. It is helpful to be around others that understand that experience and understand the anger that goes along with that and the profound sadness and the what ifs. Well, what if I had done something? What if I had been there sooner? What if I had checked in? Why didn't I see the signs? How could I have not known this? And those are all normal things to ask ourselves. But the truth is, at the end of the day, we don't always see those things. And we, you know, no matter what we have done, sometimes people are very determined and they are living in a place of despair.
Is it fair to call suicide the ultimate act of selfishness?
I think that it is called that. And again, for me, I reframe it in terms of despair. That, yes, does it feel selfish? Yes, because people are left behind. And people are left with an intense residue of loss. But again, when you think about, would we say that about cancer and would we say that about other things?
Mike was the example that seems to be almost the ultimate cliche that you hear always. He was the last person you would ever imagine would take his own life.
Yeah, and that makes it so hard, right? Because, you know, when we see others that we think, you know, would, you know, maybe be more at risk for that, a lot of times it's people that we don't see those signs.
Well, let me ask you, with only about a minute left, if we might be able to offer a little more positive, specific advice. What is it that you shouldn't say to people who have lost someone 3 days ago?
I know how you feel.
Don't say that.
Yeah, I know how you feel, or it was God's plan, or... they're better off. There's many things that people say well-intentioned, but are not helpful. The most important thing we can do is understand that there are no perfect words. There's not a magic wand or word that we can say that's going to take the pain away. And so just being present and being a good listener and offering that space, holding people in that space and being able to hear whatever comes out. Is the most important thing we can do so that people are not alone and not to forget
them. How about avoiding, he's in a better place now?
Yeah, right, because I would think, I don't want him in that place. I want him here.
No, Hawaii is a better place.
Yeah.
but that wasn't what happened. And what happened is you got a chance to perhaps learn a little bit more about grieving on The God Show. I'm Pat McMahon.